is Aging Forward, a podcast from Mayo Clinic about the science behind healthy aging and longevity. Each episode, we explore new ways to take care of our long-term health, the health of our loved ones, and our community, so we can all live longer and better. I'm Dr. Christina Chen, a geriatrician and internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And this episode, we're talking about chronic pain and how to live well in the face of it. Our guest today is Dr. Jake Strand, a palliative care physician and the current chair of the Mayo Clinic Enterprise Center for Palliative Medicine. Dr. Strand has been recognized for multiple educational initiatives and his teaching and research, particularly some of his innovative work currently with the advanced prediction models using AI and machine learning. Welcome, Dr. Strand.
Oh, thanks so much, Dr. Chen. I'm delighted to be here.
Dr. Strand, we would just love to learn more about what you do as a palliative care provider. I still struggle sometimes when people ask, what is palliative medicine? It's kind of a foreign concept for them still,
You
know? And how do you describe that to people? How does this differ from other forms of medical care?
It is still something that we explain a lot. And really what we're doing is working as an extra layer of support for a patient with a serious illness to help manage pain and other symptoms that are affecting their quality of life. And those can be physical symptoms, psychological symptoms, but also attending to their spiritual needs, their community-based needs, in order to help them live as well as they can for as long as they can with the best quality of life. And it's something that we offer really for patients who are going through curative intent types of treatments and for patients for whom they will live with this condition for a long time. The other part of our role is to allay their fears that somehow this represents a major change in their care. Really, it's an additive form for their care. And our job is to also be a sounding board for patients, their family members, for those questions that sometimes are hard to ask, and really be a kind of a neutral party in talking through that and supporting them through those decisions and those discussions.
How many people in your practice would you say have chronic pain?
So pain is the most common condition that someone will get referred to see me or one of my colleagues in palliative care, whether it's in the hospital setting or whether it's in the outpatient setting. And the big reason for that is that for a lot of chronic conditions, pain at some point rears its ugly head. And it's a condition that many will face in patients who have a very serious illness, maybe an illness that can't be cured, but can be simply treated over a long period of time. But also for a lot of us, just as our bodies continue to get older, we experience more breakdown of the body in a natural way, and that can sometimes also result in pain. And so it's a really common thing.
That leads perfectly into my next question, because the prevalence of pain as we age and start to develop issues like arthritis and neuropathy, mm-hmm. I mean, the prevalence seems to be increasing just yearly.
So I think that's exactly right. And I think we see it probably most acutely in illnesses like cancer, mm-hmm. heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or other lung conditions. Certainly, pain increases the longer people live with that illness. As people age, we develop pain from all sorts of conditions and then have to figure out what is the impact of that pain. And I think this is a really important point, is thinking through how we define pain. Because for many, many years, unfortunately, in the healthcare setting, pain was largely ignored. And we saw, particularly in patients of different socioeconomic backgrounds and racial and ethnic groups, it was ignored and unfortunately continues to be downplayed still in our healthcare system. What has changed is that pain became this additional vital sign mm-hmm. that was really sort of pushed for recognition. Now, you can't walk into a clinic without someone asking you to rate your pain from 0 to 10.
Yeah.
So that's good in some ways, right? It's good in that it allows people to voice the degree of severity. But what it doesn't do is help us figure out how much that pain is impacting their function and quality of life, mm-hmm. which is really what we're all after.
So it's being more recognized now. We're asking more about it. I feel like there's still quite a bit of misconception around pain management and perhaps allowing people not to be as truthful or open to admitting how much pain they're in. Can you share some of that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I think we see that lack of recognition or lack of discussion about it on both sides.
Yeah.
On one hand, we might screen people for it, but then we may not take it as seriously for some patient populations as we should. And then there's the other side of that, which is that patients may feel disincentivized to talk about their pain. Either they don't want to be seen as a difficult patient, as complaining. They may not feel like they're calls for pain control are going to be believed. They may also worry that they are going to be seen as a drug seeker or someone who just wants medications. And I have patients actually who they don't want to tell us about their pain levels because they're worried that all we're going to do is prescribe the medications. Yeah. Part of that, I think, is really the role that opioids play in pain management. And I think the opioid epidemic and the appropriate recognition by people in the community and the lay press for how devastating it has been for so many people has also continued to muddy the waters about pain recognition, management, and the impact on quality of life.
Mm-hmm. How do you approach breaking down some of those barriers?
Yeah.
I've had so many people come into my office, you can clearly tell that they're uncomfortable and they don't want to talk about it and they feel like it's this topic of added burden to the conversation. What's your approach towards just breaking down that stigma?
I think part of what I start my visits with is let's list a couple of things that you want to make sure we address today that are affecting how you live your life and your quality of life day to day. So really getting that patient voice and generating that list. And then I think you hit on an important point. Observation is still really important, whether it's through video visits or whether it's in-person visits. And just saying, you know, you look uncomfortable. Is that something that we should talk about today? And I think sometimes if it is clear that they're uncomfortable or it feels that way and there's a reticence to talk about it, it's also just laying on the table that one of the reasons we ask these questions are to really figure out what's most important to you as you think about the way you live your life on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And if there are things that we can do to help you live your life better, then we want to partner together in doing that. It's not necessarily going to be pushing a medication or a specific agenda, but just to understand what you live through on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. One question that I think can be helpful in talking about this is just, you know, tell me about a normal day. What do you do? Mm-hmm. And how does that compare to what you did 10 years ago? And could it be better? So those are some things that sometimes setting the groundwork for a closer partnership can be useful in our practice.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And just backtrack a little bit. Earlier, you mentioned defining pain, that's critical, but also defining the type of pain they're experiencing because there's so many different variations of pain. And I think a lot of us don't realize that it's not just arthritic inflammatory. Yeah. There's many other layers of that. There's acute versus chronic, and we have to distinguish, define those two.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still recovering from a judo injury from 2 weeks ago, and it's like, okay, it's finally getting better, but learning to live with something that extreme every single day, that must be extremely challenging. And what leads to this chronic day-to-day pain experience?
Such a good question. And I think you hit on something important, which is that I have not met a person yet who hasn't experienced some form of acute pain, whether it's, like you said, a judo injury, or for those who are less athletic, you know, running into something. And so that acute pain can last minutes. It can last hours, days. Yeah. I think what we start to see when people talk about chronic pain is where that initial injury or an injury that keeps continuing over and over again extends many weeks to months. A classic definition of chronic pain is that something that was initially acute has continued for many weeks to months. And again, there can also be the residual of something acute, right? So you have an injury, you may undergo surgery, and that fixed the underlying problem that was causing the pain, but there is ongoing residual injury that people experience in both an intensity of discomfort, but also an impairment in function. Mm-hmm. Those are some questions that hopefully clinicians of all stripes are asking people when they come, what led to this? You know, talk me through that. Mm-hmm. We also know that some types of chronic pain are more impairing than others. There are people who have experienced major surgeries and live with some residual pain and yet continue to function very well. They have figured out ways to cope with that pain and it becomes, like you said, something that they deal with on a day-to-day basis, but it doesn't impair their function to the degree that does for others. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have no good reason as to understand why that takes place for some patients. Mm-hmm. One example that I give is I take care of a lot of patients with advanced forms of cancer, and I have patients who walk into my office and I review their scans and I see that they have cancer in so many different bones in their body, I'm predicting that they're going to come in with significant pain.
Right.
And they are up walking around, they're functional, they're taking Tylenol once in a while. And their biggest concern is actually difficulty with their sleep or with relationships, and they're not related to pain. And then I have patients who have, say, a new diagnosis of cancer, and maybe only in one spot, and that spot has become so debilitating that they can't get out of bed. So I think a lot of this is just, it can be challenging because the human body is quite unique in the way that people experience pain. So it's hard to predict just from a single test or a single experience. Mm-hmm. And maybe the last thing I'll say in that regard is that it's not just these physical properties, right? We all bring to our health experience experiences, a number of factors that influence pain. I think physicians and healthcare providers often lump this into psychosocial factors, but we know patients with untreated mental health concerns like depression and anxiety experience worse pain. There are actually different spiritual backgrounds in which they might experience pain differently because of the way they view that source of pain and the importance of it in their processing of an advanced illness. And so I think it also is incumbent upon us to ask not just the timeline and maybe why this is happening, but also what are those other factors in that person's life that are influencing how they might be experiencing that pain in that moment.
Do you find that older adults experience pain differently, or perhaps they behave differently? And what are some signs that for them, pain may not be as adequately managed?
Yeah, I think certainly our older adult population, as they are going through the aging process, they have likely experienced pain numerous times before. And a lot of people have figured out adaptation mechanisms to be able to cope with that. I think back to my own grandfather who had any number of bone fractures, had prostate cancer and had surgery, and then had radiation, and then had neuropathy from that, and still was climbing around on the roof at age 92 and then fell off the roof and had another acute injury, right? And pain for him was something that he figured out ways to manage it, and it bothered him only when it prevented him from doing the really important stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, he kind of accepted this limitation over time as sort of, yeah, I'm getting a little bit older, but if it doesn't allow me to do these activities, then I'm really frustrated. And other people internalize that in a very different way. They internalize that, and it becomes something that I think, as you talked about in an earlier example, they don't want to talk about, they don't want to express. And you see it borne out in just a retreat from daily function. So maybe people are spending more time in bed or in a chair. Mm-hmm. They're not doing those activities that they used to do. And that withdrawal from their social circles or from family get-togethers or other activities might be representative of untreated pain that we just haven't been smart enough to ask the right questions to understand. For folks who have trouble actually describing their pain because maybe they have communication difficulties, they've had a stroke in the past, they've had memory loss, that can come out in behavior changes. And I think this is where I lean on colleagues like yourself to really be more thoughtful about how we ask those questions and how we screen for pain, because there are ways to screen for pain when patients can't actually answer those questions.
I love that you mentioned the issues with people with dementia or cognitive impairment, especially in long-term care facilities. And they did a good study on this a while back in BMJ, where they showed if we just give people a tiered, structured approach with pain management, their behavior settled down.
Yeah.
So we're not asking about it because we don't really know that they're sitting there in pain. I also recall a pain specialist who went through kind of the physiologic changes with aging, and he mentioned that as we age, our pain threshold sort of increases, but the tolerance decreases.
So what I mean by that is, as we age, the pain experience changes such that it takes more to experience pain, so the threshold increases, but the tolerance decreases, meaning that once we get to that threshold and experience that pain, it's much more intense, much more uncomfortable, and more painful.
And so you could see people sitting around with a broken hip, and they won't complain, but they go through surgery, and they're in so much pain afterwards.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of physiological change.
Really important nuances there. Yeah, that's it's a great point. And I think you really hit on the head that if we aren't asking the question, or we can't ask the question for the reasons you mentioned, we still have to be really suspicious that there could be something when we're seeing behaviors that are either out of the norm or that, again, are impacting their function and quality of life. And you're going to hear me say that probably over and over again, is that a pain level is just that. It's a number, but it has to mean something. And so that's where thinking about what that function looks like, we often uncover a lot of surprises, as you appropriately note.
Did you know that women typically spend the last 14 years of their lives navigating health issues? Research says we control about 70 to 90% of our health and longevity, but most women don't take advantage of all the ways to improve life and live longer. Mayo Clinic Press's new book, Ageless Aging, offers a new way for women to age while gaining wisdom, resilience, and experience. Take control of your aging journey today. You can buy Ageless Aging at mcpress.mayoclinic.org and use code AGING for 10% off your order today.
you know, when I see people in pain, it breaks my heart to see them suffering every day, that misery that they're going through and pleading to make it go away quickly. But in most situations, it takes time.
Yeah.
As you're approaching that type of situation, how do you effectively guide your patients? Like, what's the first few steps you take to get them on the right track?
You know, I think the first thing is just good old-fashioned communication. And that sounds, you know, a little glib, and it's not meant to be. It's that we jump right to how can I fix, as opposed to, you know, what is this going to look like going forward? And of course, we don't hold the keys to the future. But one of the things that I talk about is, if this is something that just recently happened, if we can get this pain under better control, what are the things that you're going to be doing? Mm-hmm. Like, what is pain standing in the way of? And so that way we can judge our success if we got there. So the patient says, gosh, I really struggle to bend over and pick up my grandchild, or I want to be able to walk down to the common room for mealtime. Those are some things that pain is limiting with me right now. Then we can try to think through, especially if we think there's a reasonable expectation for that to get better. Okay, so if we aren't meeting that level of functional improvement, what else do we need to do differently? Mm-hmm. And what's that approach that we need to take to try to get that person back to a previous level of functioning? For folks who have had pain for a long time, or that we think is pain is likely just to continue to get worse over time, then it's a similar expectation setting that, you know, we don't have a way to make the pain go away completely. But let's think through what life can look like when we have more tools to manage that pain. And really, you hit on an important term, suffering. You know, what way is this pain contributing to suffering? And can we relieve that suffering in some way that allows you to have some improved quality of life? So it's really, I think, in the beginning about expectation setting. And in my practice over the last dozen or so years here at Mayo Clinic, we see that most people take to that really, really well. I would say in general, our experience is that with good conversation and clear communication and bi-directional communication, not just me talking at our patients, we can get to a space where people feel like there can be an outcome that they understand and can process and can cope with, even if it's not ideal. So I think that's the first kind of chunk, is really setting those expectations and what do we want to shoot for in terms of functional improvement. So I think that's the first step.
I love that approach because I think it takes a step back to look at the person as a whole and to understand them in a way that's meaningful.
Yeah.
Because to your earlier point, you know, sometimes it's hard for them to express it because the first thing that they anticipate for us to do is to push the meds.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We're not doing that. We're going to take a step back to say, all right, let's focus on the bigger picture here. And then maybe medications can be part of that equation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do we do that safely? How do we do that while reducing the risks and optimizing the benefits? What's your approach to that?
This sometimes comes across as being cliched, but I think the non-medication things always come first. And the reason is because those are things that are going to continue, hopefully, even when medications may no longer be needed or the same medicines are needed. So what are those activities that we can do to help people improve their functional capacity? So exercise, in whatever way we interpret that word, is the first thing that I talk about. And for a lot of people, that is doing some basic mobility in a chair. Mm-hmm. And if that's what we can accomplish, for a lot of people, that's important because it's about personal dignity and transfers. Like, those are basic things that are really important.
Right.
And if that's what our goal is, then let's start there with trying to improve some core strength and even just trying to relieve stiffness for people who may not get out of bed because they think, for your example of somebody who was sitting around with a fractured hip, you know, maybe they don't walk again. But being in bed and being stiff and uncomfortable for the rest of your life is really, it's awful. And so what are some things we can do to reduce stiffness and improve flexibility, even in limited situations? All the way to folks who are stepping up their activity and walking 5 minutes a day, to the week after that, walking 7 minutes a day, and so on and so forth. So really about taking that whole person look and figuring out what is the level of exercise and activity and flexibility that we can achieve. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's very basic. We can print out some things in the office and we can practice it together. Sometimes it's really helpful to see a physical therapist and an occupational therapist who can give people a rundown on here's what you can do safely. And then sometimes there are folks who benefit tremendously from aggressive physical therapy, even for conditions that maybe we can't cure. I have a number of patients who, after a diagnosis of metastatic cancer, we'll try to really aggressively rehab them to maintain that strength because it's also a way of relieving pain around the areas that maybe the cancer is getting into. So I think it's really starting with some of the exercise and flexibility pieces. And then there are so many other therapies that we don't think enough about. Some people kind of categorize them as integrative medicines or alternative therapies. I don't like that terminology. These are just different approaches to achieving functional goals. So acupuncture, acupressure, massage, different movement-based philosophies can be really meaningful for people to try to integrate.
I just want to put a quick plug in for acupuncture. As someone who is trained in this practice, it has helped so many people with chronic pain, not just cancer-related pain, but migraines, back pain. So Medicare does pay for the indication of back pain, but also for day-to-day things like arthritis or hot flashes for women. So there's a lot to explore there. Very simple, very easy, non-painful. So for people who are hesitant about that practice, it's worth exploring.
Again, this is part of those healing therapies that many people are probably not aware of and probably wondering, well, why does that kind of help? And I think we do see in our practice frequently that acupuncture and massage are really critical for many patients who experience both acute and chronic pain. And sometimes you try one and you don't like it and it's just not something that vibes with you, and that's okay. You try a different thing. And so I think being able to talk with patients about the range of options that we have to try to improve function, flexibility, and activity is helpful when thinking about the non-medication based interventions.
There's so much to explore, but also I could see how it can become a little bit difficult to navigate. You know, you've got to see my acupuncturist and go to physical therapy and get some massage here and there. And there's a lot to kind of advocate for yourself.
Yeah, I think you've hit an important point, which is the advocacy. So I think overall, and this is sort of slight editorializing, our healthcare system doesn't do a good job of matching sort of what's going to best benefit the patient to what is available, because there's so much stuff that's available and it's not all coordinated. I think that's why a program like this podcast is so important, because the more information we can get into the hands of patients and their caregivers to act as advocates, asking those questions, what else is available? What other treatments in our area can we try? So I think that's one piece, is that self-advocacy. Systems that are doing this well are advocating on behalf of their patients. So one of the things I feel so lucky about is to be part of such a big team, because our nurses and our outpatient palliative care clinic really take on this role. They will sit down with a patient, talk with me about what our goals are, and then they'll start to say, I think we should refer you here. And here is a great massage therapist who lives a couple of miles from your house. And here's the coverage that you can get from Medicare for this number of sessions. Or, hey, this is what's going to cost. Does that seem like it's going to work? Oh, okay, it doesn't. Let's try this instead. So I think that's where good clinics and good healthcare groups are using community advocates, nurse navigators, and other members of the team to help do some of that advocacy as well. So I think that's an important part. The last piece I'll say is for folks who live far away from a lot of healthcare centers, that gets really challenging. And so one thing we are learning more and more about is the value of virtual-based interventions, even for managing pain. And so I think we're going to see more and more over the next 3 to 5 years on which patients benefit from this the most and what things we can do reliably. And I'm always an optimist. Hopefully our healthcare system and the payment models that we have with insurance and so forth will start to catch up.
Let's just touch on therapeutics. I know there's a concern and fear of the opioid epidemic, but safe use of medications or a combination of medications, I think it's helpful for people to know it's okay.
Yeah. So I think what's helpful to know is that all medications are tools. They are not inherently good nor bad. They can be used badly, and they can be used for some people really meaningfully. Many of them have side effects that we have to manage. And so we're constantly weighing benefits and burdens of any individual therapy. So that's how I first and foremost think about them myself and talk about them with my patients. Is this tool going to be helpful for us or not? And if it becomes more harmful than it is helpful, then we get rid of it and we look for something different. So when we think about particular in patients who are aging, what we see is that a lot of the non-opioid-based treatments, for the non-opioid medications, this really is a basket of medications that are topical creams that you can get over the counter, many of which are very helpful. Some people really find benefit. Creams like lidocaine-containing creams or menthol-based-containing creams. Some have mild anti-inflammatories in them. And my general rule for folks is, unless there's an obvious reason not to do it, which are individualized to each person, topical creams and patches, if you can afford them and you can find them in your area, I say try them out, because some people find them useful for managing aches and pains. They can be also a nice distractor. In certain circumstances, they can, but in most circumstances, they're not going to cause a lot of side effects. One word that I would say about topicals, though, that has come up over the past decade is that compounding pharmacies over the years have really expanded the number of topicals. So they take lots of medications that are often given by mouth or through an IV and put them into creams, and the cost can be substantial. And there's been a couple of good controlled studies that have shown that there's not a lot of good benefit for these compounded creams for most patients compared to placebo. So I think caution is needed because they can be really expensive for patients and maybe not provide the same benefit as, you know, a $5 cream over the counter.
Darn, I was putting a lot of hope in that.
And I do have some patients for whom they do work, and there's sort of mechanistic reasons for their pain why they work really effectively.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, well, let's just try all of these creams instead of the pills. It hasn't panned out, unfortunately. And then there's a whole list of non-opioid medications that people are generally taking by mouth that some are very helpful. They're often medications that started out as a treatment for something else that we've adopted into treatment for pain. Some are antidepressants that are actually really effective for certain types of nerve pain. And so we counsel patients that I'm not giving this to you because I think you're depressed. I'm giving it to you because we use it as a pain medication. Here are the side effects to look out for and so forth. So I think talking with a clinician about some of those non-opioid medications is important. For folks who are aging, so our older adults, one of the challenges is that the side effects from those medications might be just as bad as side effects, or worse, as side effects from opioids. And so sometimes, I had a patient once tell me, well, doc, why are you jumping right to oxycodone for this pain that I'm having? And I said, because these other four medicines that we would normally try first for you are actually going to make you sicker because your kidneys aren't working very well, your liver's not working very well, and these are the side effects that you're going to have. So sometimes you'll see clinicians who may not use those medications because they might be causing more problems than they're helping by avoiding an opioid. And then sort of just to briefly touch on opioids, and, you know, opioids are strong painkillers. Mm-hmm. They used to be called narcotics. Unfortunately, that term just really doesn't define what these medications are. So opioid is the term we use. Opioids are tools, and they, like any tool, they have been poorly used in a lot of settings and have caused a lot of harm. And we won't go into all of that today, but for some people, they still are an important tool for helping them with a good function and quality of life, and that it can be done safely. And there are medications in that class that have actually emerged over the last several years that we think are much more effective and safe, particularly for our older adult patient population. And so that is something to talk to your clinicians about. One example is a medication called buprenorphine, which is a medicine that can be delivered in a very low dose through a patch. And it is much safer, we think, as it relates to some of the really scary complications of opioids than some of its cousins. And so these are, you know, the goal all of the time is that we're constantly learning and we're constantly trying to figure out the lowest dose, the safest dose, and the shortest period of time we have to use something to manage that pain.
Share maybe just one story of a patient that you felt like did really well who has a success story with the pain experience.
I think I'll share one that maybe is a little bit atypical because it's not the had pain, everything got better, lived a happy life after, right? I think that's something that I think people in general understand that the world is more complicated than that. And so I'll share the story of a gentleman who was in his 80s who had been diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer and had done some initial treatments. And then the cancer was not growing really fast, but also didn't seem to be responding. And he had gotten sick on some of the treatments that he used. Some of them were causing him to be really tired. So he just decided, you know, I'm going to not take any more treatments related to the cancer other than things affecting my quality of life. And so that was something where initially we didn't know what that meant for how long he was going to live, but he had some very specific goals. He wanted to be able to play with his grandkids. So I think that that's a common one that I hear. He also wanted to be able to take a trip with his kids to a very special lake that they had in their family memories. And he wanted to be able to continue to go down for as long as he could to get coffee with some of his friends he had made in the neighborhood once a week. So we kind of laid out that maybe some of those were going to be harder than others, but, you know, let's start with the basic of being able to go down and get coffee with friends. And what was limiting him was really significant significant back pain. And what I really learned a lot from and really appreciated about this discussion was that he had had a family member who had overdosed on opioids. Mm-hmm. And so he just said, look, it's just too emotionally hard for me to even consider taking those medications based on what I saw. And he could rationalize that not everybody who takes those medications will have addiction or substance use disorder from it. But it was just too painful to conceive of. So we did a number of things. We did massage and acupuncture because fortunately he lived in a town that had people who did that, and he had saved up some money and he thought, you know, my life expectancy may not be as long, so I'm going to spend some of that money on, and it wasn't a lot of money, but he felt comfortable about that decision. And we used some over-the-counter pain medications that he could take. So just 2 extra strength Tylenol twice a day. And he felt like that helped. And their local YMCA had a special to get in to do water aerobics. And so he did some water aerobics and he didn't have the stamina, but he could do some of it. And even the act of doing a couple of those things made him feel like he was taking some control. So it wasn't that he was kind of stuck in a healthcare system. He was doing some things for himself. And he got to play with his grandchildren more frequently. You know, it was still hard for him, but it was something he could do more frequently. He was able to go down to the lake. It was later than he wanted, and it was in a wheelchair. And when I asked him about that, I said, oh, was that disappointing? And he said, you know what? I used to think I'd never wanted to be in a wheelchair. I never wanted to use a walker. But those things allowed me more independence because I was able to get outside my house and go do the thing that was really important. A lot of people associate with a loss of independence. For him, were a way to be more independent if he wasn't using them. For me, that made me feel really, really proud that he was able to share that with our team. And I think that through my relationship with him in our practice, it was also something where, again, we needed to stay away from some of those medications until the very end of his life where he was okay with that. Mm-hmm. And it was just a conversation over time. So it wasn't something where we needed to convince him to take something. It was, we're going to talk about this over time and you're going to guide us. And it felt very much in that model that we idealize, which is that shared patient model where we're each bringing some to the table, mm-hmm. learning from each other. So that was a really special case that I still think about and teach to our trainees.
Oh, that really warms my heart. And it makes me so happy to hear that you feel proud of him too, because it was your journey too as his physician to see him meet his goals, and that you feel that sense of pride that he was able to do that. As a palliative medicine provider, what do you think you've learned about the concept of healthy aging through the eyes of that practice? And what does aging forward mean to you?
So I think what I have learned, and I am continuing to learn, is that what that means, that idea of aging forward looks like, has a very different lens depending on that person's stories and how they've journeyed thus far to that process of aging. So I think sometimes we have in our minds a sense that, well, I don't want them to have to go through X, or I don't want them to, we hear this a lot, we don't want to go to a nursing home. And I have seen that for many people, that journey and what quality of life means to each individual varies so much that there is not a right way. And really, the only right way that I've been able to figure out is that if we are able to partner with people to help them be able to explain to us what quality of life and function means to them, then that's when we're meeting those goals, not the goals that I think that they should have. And I know that sounds obvious in some ways, but I think all of us have this view that there are things we want for others that we care about, whether it's our family or patients that we take care of. And yet we just have to be curious enough to know that that may and will look very different for individual people as they age forward.
Yeah, love that. Thank you for sharing those wonderful pearls with us today.
Well, thanks for having me and thanks for doing this.
That's all for this episode. Hopefully you're feeling a little bit more informed, inspired, and empowered. If you have a topic suggestion for a future episode, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. For more Aging Forward episodes and resources, head to mayoclinic.org/agingforward. And if you found the show to be helpful, please subscribe and make sure to rate and review us on your podcast app. It really helps others find our show. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay curious and stay active.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.